We all know it. We are saved by grace through faith. Our ticket is sealed. Our relationship with Jesus ensures us a place with Him in heaven. But what about holiness? Where does holiness come in? Why is holiness important? To give you my impression of it, I want to take you in a different direction. Is there anybody here who has not seen the movie Saving Private Ryan? Okay. Set in World War II, four brothers enlist to go off to fight. Three are killed in one day in the Battle of Normandy on D-Day. Word trickles up the chain of command straight to the president. He says, three sons are enough for any family to have to bury for freedom. Go get him. They send a man named Captain John Miller and his team into France to find Private James Ryan. Not an easy task, but when they do find him, they have an even tougher task because James Ryan refuses to go. When asked, "What are we supposed to tell your mother when we leave you here?" he said, tell her that you found me with the only brothers that I have left, and I refuse to desert them in the time of need." So Captain Miller makes the tough decision that his entire team will stay with Private James Ryan, see him through the mission, and then get him home. What ensues is a lot of battles and the building of a strong friendship between these two men. James Ryan finds out what Captain Miller's men don't even know about him. The big mystery is, what did Miller do before the war? Captain Miller tells him he was a high school teacher with a loving wife waiting at home for him, and that he would do anything if it meant that he earned his way back. In the final battle to complete the mission, among almost all of the team that was sent to get him, Captain Miller is also killed. And with his dying breath, he says two words to James Ryan: earn this. Be worthy. Go home and live a life worthy of the sacrifice that was made for you. I'll play a little clip. Now that's fiction and that's Hollywood, but we all feel that, don't we? I mean, can you not see every day of that man's life how he must have got up and attempted to live the best life he could because of what he had been given? Every decision that he made was more important because of what was done for him. Now, Captain Miller wasn't perfect. He wasn't sinless. And He gave that man an opportunity for 50, 60 years, a wife, a family, and a good life. What did the sacrifice of a perfect man do for us? Eternity. Infinitely more valuable. And an infinitely more valuable sacrifice. That, to me, is the reason why I care about holiness. It's a response to the sacrifice I was given. So if we want to know how to apply holiness in our lives, we need a great teacher. I'm not it. We need the best teacher if we want the best instruction. The best teacher was Jesus. Now, all of the Gospels have their own unique purpose. They have their own unique style. They have their own unique strengths. But what makes Matthew special? It's not a mistake that Matthew records more of Jesus' words than anyone else. See, Matthew was a tax collector. He was a very successful one. He was sitting in a tax booth, which you don't do unless you've risen to a pretty high place. But one of the first things he would have learned as a tax collector is a form of writing called tachygraphy. Tachygraphy was what they used when they would be assessing taxes, and the senior tax collector would walk around, 2 goats, 4 sheep, 6 lamb, and the young tax collector would have to write all that down. It was a shorthand. It enabled him to be able to capture every single word when he was practicing. So when we look at a passage like the Sermon on the Mount, it's the longest, most complete sermon that Jesus ever gave, recorded in Scripture, because of the abilities of Matthew. It's basically a true transcript of Jesus' words. The German martyr of World War II, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, became obsessed, for lack of a better word, with the Sermon on the Mount because he believed that the vast majority, 95% of the Christian life could be accomplished if one were to master the teachings of the Sermon on the Mount. Jesus covered everything so well in this passage that you, if you could find a man who could live this out, it'd be extraordinary. Charles Spurgeon, the Prince of Preachers, described the Sermon on the Mount. He said it describes the saved, described the Beatitudes. He said it describes the saved, not the path to be saved. So when we start with the Beatitudes, does anyone need a Bible? We'll be in Matthew 5 today. So Jesus walked up on this mountain with a crowd around him, sat down, and began to teach his disciples. And he starts out with a passage we all know as the Beatitudes. The first word in every one of the eight Beatitudes is blessed. That's a clumsy description of the word Ashrei, the Hebrew word Ashrei, that it is meant to signify. Ashrei was, a lot of people in some form say happiness. It's a form of joy or a form of happiness that is a reward for something endured. It's almost like a congratulations type of thing. Okay, so we have these eight Beatitudes. Jesus said, blessed are the poor in spirit, because theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when they revile and persecute you and say all manner of evil against you for my sake. Rejoice and be exceedingly glad, for great is your reward in heaven. For so they persecuted the prophets who were before them. Okay. At one time, I memorized the entire Sermon on the Mount. Can't do it anymore. But I kind of stumbled along the Beatitudes, and I never really studied what the Beatitudes were all about. I'm probably in the minority among Christians when it comes to that. Many, many churches preach almost exclusively on Beatitudes. So what are the Beatitudes? Is it specific blessings for certain people? Most theologians say that it follows a pattern, number one, almost like a plant. You have the roots. The first three of the Beatitudes, let me go back. The most common theme that I came across in the Beatitudes is that this describes the life and growth of a Christian, the progression of the Christian life. See, we start with poverty of spirit. It starts where the law leaves us. Because only when you understand the law that they lived under and understand how far you fall short, you understand what poverty of the spirit truly is. You have nothing. You're a beggar. The second is those who mourn. poverty of your spirit causes you to mourn. And we are assured that we will be comforted. The third one's often misunderstood, the meek. We're told that Moses was meek, and we're given some platitudes about meekness is not weakness. What is meekness and why is it important? The passage, "the meek shall inherit the earth," sort of parallels passages in Psalm 37 where it describes a man who does not go after or envy the evil and who waits on the Lord. Meekness is best understood, in my opinion, by animals. A meek animal is willingly submissive to its master. Doesn't necessarily mean it's not a powerful animal, capable of great things, but it does mean that it's submissive to its master. Slavery, the most controversial statement I will make today, slavery is a wonderful thing if your master is perfect. You have nothing to concern yourself with but the will of your master if you know that he is perfect. So it's like a yoke. And we meekly choose to put ourselves under it. Now, interestingly enough, it says the meek will inherit the earth. It almost points back to us being the rightful heirs to Adam's kingdom. I mean, that's where we went wrong. Adam had the perfect life. He walked and talked with God daily. He knew no sin. He knew no toil. He knew no hardship. But he took that yoke off and laid it down and decided to go his own way. So when we put that yoke back on us, we become the rightful heirs of Adam. Those are the roots. Those are how it starts. Then we go to the actual life of the plant, the life of this progression. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be filled. Hunger and thirst are not passive needs. True hunger, true thirst make you desperate. There is very little a human will not do to satisfy a deep hunger or a deep thirst. Read some of the Old Testament sometimes. What starving people are willing to do. So it's a passionate drive for righteousness that you see it most often in young believers, new believers. They can't get enough. They've got to read the Bible. They've got to know more and more. Unfortunately, a lot of times that hunger fades and we get complacent. But the the life and the growth, the Christian life, is satisfying the hunger and the thirst for righteousness. Then we come to the fruits of the tree. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. So the next thing that you realize, once you are on your way in this Christian walk, is that because you have come to where you are out of the poverty of your spirit, it's very difficult not to show mercy to someone who is in the same condition you were in. It's more than empathy. You were where they are. You can't expect them to be anywhere else. So mercy is an easy next step. The next fruit is blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. For they shall see God. Can you imagine that? Even Moses didn't get to see God. I mean, that's should be the desire of all our hearts, to someday be let into the very presence of God, to look upon His face. But what we know about God is that He is perfect. He is perfection. And nothing impure can survive in His sight. So we must be pure in heart. And as we go through this Christian life, our heart continues to be purified. Next is, blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. What do you need to be a peacemaker? You have to have peace to give it. And no man can ever have peace until he has peace with God. If you are not right with your Creator, it's impossible to be at peace. John 13:35. Go to it real quick. Jesus said, "By this, all people will know that you are my disciples, if you have love for one another." Well, the hallmark of being Jesus' disciple, being a Christian, living the Christian life, is loving your brethren. The love of your fellow man compels us to make peace, to seek peace, to heal peace,
broken relationships. This passage actually kind of foreshadows later in the Sermon on the Mount. I'll paraphrase. See, this says, "Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God." Later on, Jesus talks about how we are to love our enemies. How we are to do good to those who spitefully use us and persecute us. Pray for those who mistreat us. And then he says, so that we can be like our Father. For our Father causes rain to fall on the just and on the unjust. And so on. God does not simply favor His own. He also blesses His enemies. And because of that, Jesus closes that passage by saying, so that you will be sons of your Father in heaven. And then he says, you shall be perfect, just as your Father in heaven is perfect. It takes a lot to bless our enemies. It takes near perfection. But that's the standard. The final beatitude has to do with the world's reaction to the Christian life. When you exemplify the first seven, you can count on the world to persecute you. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Notice how it reverts right back to the first beatitude, because theirs is the kingdom of heaven. He closes off this passage, and then he elaborates. Blessed are you when they revile and persecute you and say all manner of evil against you falsely for my sake. Rejoice and be exceedingly glad, for great is your reward in heaven. For so they persecuted the prophets who were before you. being persecuted for doing right is a difficult thing. We can endure, should endure, when we are punished for what we do wrong. But when we do what is right and are punished specifically for that, our hearts revolt against that. But when that happens, we are brought in line with Jesus Himself. We kind of put ourselves in the same boat with Peter and John when they were beaten by the Sanhedrin in Acts, and they went out and rejoiced that they were counted worthy to suffer for Christ's sake. Okay, so we'll cover a little bit more of this since we got there, and then we'll close. Jesus goes on after the Beatitudes and he begins the sermon itself. You are the salt of the earth, but if the salt should lose its taste, how shall it be made salty? It is no longer good for anything but to be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men. You are the light of the world. A city that is set on a hill cannot be hidden, nor do they light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a lampstand, and it gives light to all who are in the house. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father who is in heaven. What is it to be salt in this world? Salt is a preservative. It keeps the decay away. You think of Nineveh. And it was the repentance of Nineveh that kept them from being destroyed for many years. It doesn't keep destruction from happening, but it prolongs the process. It gives this world just a little bit longer for the Lord to be able to bring about salvation to as many as is possible. You are the light of the world. A city that is set on a hill cannot be hidden, nor do they light a lamp and put it in their basket, but on a lampstand, and it gives light to all who are in the house. We are to be light in the darkness. He did not give us this gift to sit on it. I think of his parables about the master that gives his servants talents of gold and goes away. And the first master who had 10 talents, first slave that has 10 talents, makes 10 more talents. And when he comes back, he says, "Master, your 10 talents have made 10 more." And he's praised. "Enter into the joy of your master. I will make you you have been faithful over a little. I will make you ruler over much." Second one had 3 talents. "Master, your 3 talents have made 3 talents. Enter into the joy of your Lord." Then he comes to the last one. "Master, I knew that you were a hard man who reaped where you did not sow and gathered what you did not plant. So I hid your money, and here it is returned." And that servant was chastised. "Why did you not put my money in the bank with lenders so that I would have gotten my money back with interest? You took the 1 talent and gave it to the one who had 10. And that servant was thrown out into outer darkness. See, whatever we're given, whatever gifts we're given to serve the Lord, whatever we're capable of doing for God, it doesn't matter that I can't do as much as Robert. I got to do what I can with mine to further the kingdom of God. It's not enough to say, "Thank you very much for the free ticket to heaven. I'm going to sit over here now." Doesn't work that way. There are no passengers on Jesus' boat. Everybody has an oar. And everybody is expected to row. You don't hide a lamp under a basket. You put it on a lampstand. It says we are to let our light shine so before men that they may see our good works and glorify our Father who is in heaven. Do not assume that I came to destroy the law or the prophets. I did not come to destroy, but to fulfill. For I assure you, until heaven and earth pass away, not one jot or one tittle will by any means pass from the law until all have been fulfilled. Therefore, whoever breaks one of the least of these commandments and teaches men so will be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever practices and teaches these commands will be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I tell you that unless your righteousness surpasses that of the scribes and Pharisees, you will not enter the kingdom of heaven. This was kind of a pause for me when I first started reading it. I mean, I thought the Mosaic Law was ended. He's doing away with the law and the prophets. It's now the New Testament. It's Jesus. It's all about believe and receive. So what is Jesus saying here? He's saying you had a law written down. We had to itemize every little thing you could or could not do. Now it's different. I am the fulfillment of the law and everything the prophets said. He is the law. He is the standard. The law didn't get easier. The rules actually got much harder. He'll get into that, and we'll get into that next time. But it's no longer just the letter of the law anymore. It's a living law, and that standard is absolute perfection, the perfection of God Himself. And while we are not condemned for falling short, He knows our weaknesses and He knows we will fall short daily. We are still held to the standard of perfection. He actually says, "Be ye perfect." Nothing short is the goal. If you aim for the earth, you'll get the earth. If you aim for heaven, you get the earth in the bargain. You will never exceed your expectations. If your expectations are not high enough, you limit yourself. So Jesus is literally standing before this crowd who has been... And by the way, the Beatitudes were a bomb He set off in that crowd, because they just knew whose was the kingdom of heaven. Well, it was the righteous. You're the children of Abraham, first of all. We're heirs to the kingdom of heaven. Jesus says, no, the poor in spirit, the broken, the shattered. That tax collector that He talks about in the temple,
that stood afar off would not raise his eyes to heaven and beat his breast, Lord, have mercy on me, a sinner. That's whose is the kingdom of heaven. But now he's telling them, Mosaic law, everything, all of your culture, everything you have believed is now wrapped up in me. I am the fulfillment of the law and the prophets. And as he moves forward through this sermon, he will show them just how far from the mark the old law got. And he shows them that it is a matter of not what you do, but it's a matter of the heart. It's the spirit of the thing. Let's close.